Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Dr. Weldon McWilliams, and today we have guest Dr. Zetta Elliott on the line with us this evening. Dr. Elliott, are you with us?
I am. Good evening to you.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm so glad you could take time out of your busy schedule and just talk with us this evening. We just wanted to talk with you this evening about your upcoming or your new book that's out. Before we get into a discussion about the book, we just wanted you to, if you could just tell our listeners who you are and some of the things that you are actively doing.
Sure. Well, my name is Zetta Elliott, and I'm a writer and an educator. I'm actually an assistant professor in the Center for Ethnic Studies at Borough of Manhattan Community College here in New York City. Mm-hmm. And later on this month, in just a couple of days, the 28th of February on Tuesday, my third novel for young readers comes out. It's called Ship of Souls. And like my other book, A Wish After Midnight, it incorporates some paranormal elements and some historical elements, but set in an urban environment with a multicultural cast of children. And so that's pretty much what I'm up to right now.
Okay, great, great. And if you could just tell us, what was the inspiration behind your latest book?
Ship of Souls was inspired by a few things. Like I said, I had already written about some aspects of African-American history here in New York City. A Wish After Midnight has a contemporary teenager that goes back in time and actually lives as a teenager in 1863 when Brooklyn was its own city, and she ends up surviving the New York City draft riots. And I thought writing historical fiction is a good way to get teens interested in history, because some of them, unfortunately, think history is boring. But when you have a contemporary teenager and they relate to a contemporary teen who's facing the same kind of challenges they are, and then that teen goes into the past, I found that that was kind of a good hook. And so with my next book, Ship of Souls, I knew that I wanted to reach boys. I think we need more books for African-American boys. And so I knew my protagonist would be a boy, although he does have two friends in the book, Nyla and Hakeem. But I felt like I was kind of getting signs from maybe from the universe or from the ancestors before I started writing this book. I knew that I wanted to write something that would tie in history that took place in Brooklyn, and I live very close to Prospect Park. And in Prospect Park, there are two markers for Battle Pass, which was the site of one of the very first major battles of the Revolutionary War, the Battle of Long Island. And so I thought it would be really interesting to write something that incorporated that Revolutionary War history. And then in the summer of 2010, they actually found the remains of a ship at Ground Zero. And I started thinking, you know, exactly why would you find a boat underground? Like, that just was completely bizarre to me. And, of course, it turns out that it was probably sunk to use as landfill when they were expanding Manhattan Island. But I just thought, well, there would be a ship underground because there would be passengers underground. And where would I find passengers underground? Where else but the African burial ground in Lower Manhattan? Right. So those three elements kind of came together in a narrative about a boy who's an orphan, Dimitri. He's 11 years old, and his mom dies of breast cancer, and he kind of feels like when he's put into the foster care system, he doesn't really have anyone he belongs to or any place where he belongs, and he's chosen to by a magical creature called Nuru to be Nuru's host, and that means he has to carry Nuru from Brooklyn into Lower Manhattan, but he has to stay underground. And, of course, the soldiers who died in Prospect Park, the Revolutionary War soldiers, they would also like to get their hands on Nuru because Nuru has magical powers. And so Dee and his friends end up trying to conduct this magical bird underground from Brooklyn to Lower Manhattan while being chased by these nether beings who are ghosts of Revolutionary War soldiers.
Wow. Okay. Great, great. Now, I was reading your bio, and it says that you were born in Canada. Is that correct?
It is.
Okay, and you had your, or just recently, well, not recently, but in 2003, you received your PhD in American Studies. And just from my, you know, just brief discussion with you, it seems like there was a particular or keen interest in African American Studies. Can you just give our listeners a sense of how that became of particular interest to you?
Sure. Well, that's connected to why I actually write books for kids. When I was growing up in Canada, I lived there for the first 20 years of my life, just outside of Toronto, and I never had books that had black children in them. I loved to read fantasy novels like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and The Secret Garden, and The Hobbit, and books like that, but they never featured a child that looked like me. And so after 20 years of living in a former British colony, reading lots of British literature, I was introduced in my last semester of my last year of college to Jamaica Kincaid and Toni Morrison, two really important black women writers. And I started to learn about the history of imperialism in a political science course with my first black educator, the first black professor I'd ever had. And so that was a real turning point for me. And at that point, that would have been 1993, you couldn't really find a black studies program in Canada. And even if you went back there now, 20 years later, and tried to find one, you'd be hard-pressed. I think they're trying to start one in Dalhousie, in Halifax, and they have maybe some ethnic studies courses and programs, but it's black studies as a field isn't as strong as it is here in the United States. So when I decided to go to graduate school, I knew I was going to come to the United States, and my father lived in Brooklyn, and he invited me to come down and spend the summer, and I fell in love with the city, and it was my first time living in a majority black community, and there was history everywhere. I mean, you walked past a brownstone, and it was obvious that a brownstone had been standing there for a very long time, and there were, you know, black communities that had been long-standing to find something like Weeksville, to walk past churches and see, you know, cornerstones dating back to the 1840s and 50s, and to know they were part of the Underground Railroad. I mean, to actually live alongside of that history was completely new to me because Toronto, if you've ever been, is a very modern city. It does have history, but it wasn't something that I felt was accessible when I was growing up. So when I went to graduate school, I knew I was going to focus on African American literature and culture and history, and I was specifically interested in representations of racial violence, lynching, and rape. And those aren't exactly topics for children, but, you know, when people think about slavery, they usually think about the South, and they don't think about the role that New York City played and that the North had slavery as well, and things like the New York City draft riots, race riots that went on for days. So I thought when I started to write for kids that I would want to write magical stories that put black children at the center of their own adventure. They didn't have to leave the city. They didn't have to be in a castle in England. You know, they could be right where they are in their own neighborhood and find really amazing things. So that was my, I guess, the way of using my training and my graduate school scholarship in a way that was more accessible to young readers.
Great. Now, being from Canada and stating that you spent your first 20 years there, is the Canadian experience for, I guess, the black experience in Canada, is it similar to the U.S.? What are some similarities and maybe what are some differences between the black experience in Canada and the black experience here in the United States?
Well, there are similarities and there are pretty dramatic differences. I think one of the most significant differences is that the Canadian Canada has a long history when it comes to what we call African Canadians or black Canadians. I was actually just at the African Burial Ground National Monument yesterday, and the ranger, Cyrus Foreman, was talking about Katie Ferguson, rather, and he talked about this enslaved woman who had grown up in New York City around the time of the Revolutionary War, and he talked about Canvas Town and how the British occupied New York City and then took 2,000 to 3,000 formerly enslaved African Americans with them to Canada when they left. And part of the condition was that they would get their freedom when they went to Canada. So even before, you know, that Revolutionary War period, there were blacks in Canada. There was slavery in Canada, not to the same scale as there was here in the U.S. But the black population in Canada today is primarily an immigrant community. So starting in the 1960s, we had kind of a huge wave of immigration from the Caribbean. And today we have quite a few immigrants from Africa as well. So if you were to be in Toronto or in Montreal, what you would find would be a majority of people who could trace their roots to Africa or the Caribbean, whereas that's the case here in New York City, but nationwide in the United States, you know, something, I think it's 94% of blacks in the United States are from the United States, right? They're not immigrants. Mm-hmm. So we have a much larger immigrant population. The domestic black population in Canada that's been there since the 1700s, they tend to be less visible, and they're not. I think they're more so located outside of the city in places like Buxton and St. Catharines, going back to, you know, the kind of terminus of the Underground Railroad and people who settled in those communities and have stayed there for the most part. In terms of similarities, we have, you know, struggling with issues around incarceration and police brutality. It's very, very difficult to find books by black authors for children in Canada. Only two or three black authors have a book published each year in Canada. So there are differences, dramatic differences in that regard.
Okay. And can you tell us the history of Emancipation Day in Canada? If you can tell us a little bit about that.
I cannot. I'm afraid I cannot. I did not learn anything about black Canadian history when I was growing up.
Okay.
My research has been on the United States. So
right.
I can point you to some books.
Well, is that something that, and I know that you spoke to it before, but is that something that I guess needs to dramatically increase, I guess, in Canada, just the acceptance of what we would call here maybe African American studies or black studies? Is there a black studies department or black studies as a discipline? Is that in Canada? Is that popular, or is that something that has yet to emerge?
In my experience, I would say Canada's on a 20 to 30 year lag. So
okay.
A couple of years ago, there was a huge controversy in the city of Toronto because they opened their first black school. So that's something that has been going on in the United States, you know, for decades. But that was their first attempt at doing it, and there was quite a lot of resistance, including from the black community. So you have a very different composition.
Right.
And I would say that, you know, like I said, there are, to my knowledge, there are no black studies departments except for the one that's been in the process of being founded at Dalhousie University. They have a new director running the center, Dr. Afua Cooper, and I think they're going to make great strides now that she's there. But, you know, you can take courses, and from my understanding, there are, you know, ethnic studies and sociological programs where you can study race, but it wouldn't be called black studies. Blacks are not a dominant minority group in Canada. So we aren't, in terms of numbers, we're not the dominant minority group here either in the United States. Latinos are.
Right.
But we are the dominant group because blackness, in terms of racial discourse, blackness dominates the conversation. So that is not the case in Canada.
Right. Well, and there's a common perception that in Canada and is, you know, for instance, Canada is more unified, or maybe we could, are there differences in the way that race is defined in Canada than how it is here in the United States? And, you know, as you stated, that there was even some resistance from blacks in Canada as well to have a black school. So, I mean, is there more of a sense of multiculturalism in Canada, and does that lead to a sense of unity, or is it just really a lack of availability or a lack of the knowledge within specifically African American history or something of that sort?
Mm-hmm. Well, I should say that, you know, my degree is in American studies and not Canadian studies, and I left when I was 20, so I
right.
haven't spent a lot of time studying this, and there are other people who do.
Okay.
Renata Walcott does fantastic work, and George Eliot Clark. What I can say is that Canada has an official policy of multiculturalism.
Okay.
In that regard, you know, all cultures are supposed to be protected and celebrated. But what I end up finding in Canada is that there's a discomfort talking about race. So everybody
okay.
likes to talk about culture, and everybody wants to eat some jerk chicken. Everybody wants to listen to some Kotsa music once in a while. Nobody really wants to talk about race. And from what I understand, race is not, it's almost similar to the situation in France where statistics by race are not reported by the government. That's
mm-hmm.
my understanding. So it would be very difficult to even have a conversation about discrimination because it's very difficult. So when I wanted to find out about race in publishing, I had to go compile a bunch of bibliographies because every government institution I contacted had no idea. They're just not keeping statistics, which in a way speaks to their confidence, one could say arrogance,
mm-hmm.
in thinking that they don't have a problem with race. You know?
Okay. Right. Well, let me apologize for harping so much on the Canadian experience. It was
That's
just
okay.
something that fascinated
Maybe
me.
You're interested.
But, right. Now we'll get back to your book. So I hear you're having a book party. Is that correct?
I am. We're having a launch for my latest book, Ship of Souls, and it's going to be at the African Burial Ground National Monument in Lower Manhattan.
Mm.
We're really proud and honored that they would let us have our event there. And since the book does kind of center around the burial ground, it's really kind of fitting that we should launch the book there. And it's going to be this Saturday,
great.
March 3rd, from 1 to 3 p.m., and it's free, and everyone's welcome. And, you know, if you can't make it on that day, I would encourage everyone to just go whenever you can to the African Burial Ground. They have an incredible visitor center with a theater that's always screening a movie, interactive galleries that are perfect for kids, a gift shop, and they have great events and walking tours and lectures. This month, Black History Month, they've been incredibly busy, and they're going to have another great lineup for Women's History Month next month. And the monument, which is outside, is accessible, and there's almost always a guard there, you know, from 9 in the morning till 5 at night. So really encourage people to go and learn more about this important part of American history.
Great. So that, again, is Saturday, March 3rd, from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock, correct?
Right, from 1 to 3.
Great. 1 to 3, and this is at the African Burial Ground, correct?
The African Burial Ground National Monument. It's located at 290 Broadway, which is between Duane Street and Reed Street, accessible by any number of trains. It's within a few blocks walk of a lot of trains. It's just a fantastic, fantastic site.
And can you just explain to us how you came into knowledge of a burial ground again? And if I can just ask you, if you could speak up just a little bit, there seems to be an issue with the audio. Maybe we're coming in a
sure.
little too low.
Okay. So the African Burial Ground, I guess, came into public discourse, I think, in 1991, and that was before I had actually reached New York City. I moved here in 1994. But I was actually in the process of applying for a green card, and the Immigration and Naturalization Service was in the federal building across the street. So the first interaction I had with the burial ground would be to pass the site on my way to finagle the details for my green card. And at that time, it was just a plot of grass that had a chain link fence up and a sign that said, "This is the site of the African Burial Ground." And that stayed in my memory. I was working with kids at the time in Brooklyn and wanted them to learn more about African-American history. And so we went to the New York Historical Society and we learned about Seneca Village, which was a black community that was unfortunately torn down in order to make way for Central Park in the 1850s. And we went to the Brooklyn Historical Society and I learned about Maricha Lyons and her diary and the things she had written about the New York City draft riots. So I was already interested in African-American history and making it accessible to kids. And then the Visitor Center opened, and I think that was in 2000 and, oh dear, 5 or 6. Maybe it hasn't even been that long. But the Visitor Center just is a whole other dimension, and I remember going when they first just had a couple of small rooms and watching a film and meeting some of the rangers. Ranger Doug, he's fantastic. He's the lead park ranger there. And when I finished my first novel, A Wish After Midnight, I went back and told them about it and took another walking tour with Ranger Doug. And then, you know, it's a place that I visit again and again, and you never stop learning. They always have speakers and lectures and different events, and they're a really welcoming community. So they always want people to come in and share what they know. It's not just a question of them kind of rationing information and giving you a little bit here and there. They're really just welcoming, and because I teach at BMCC, which is a few blocks over on Chamber Street, I take my classes to the burial ground, and I'll be taking three of my classes on Tuesday. I teach slavery in all of my classes, and it makes sense, you know, to introduce students to the history of slavery in New York City, because so many of them don't know that New York has a slave past, and that enslaved people were the ones who built the foundations of the colony that became the city.
Right, right. And what is your response with your young readers? As I imagine, your books are kind of geared for young readers, and what has the response been to your books thus far?
Well, I had the chance, thanks to the Brooklyn Public Library, they sent me into 7 schools this month, and so I had the chance to present before 100 kids in each school, and they were absolutely just hanging on my words, really. I mean, the idea of it's not the history so much that draws them in. It's the mystery, right? The intrigue. Uh-huh. Like, they've been to these places. They've been to Prospect Park. They've been to the Botanic Garden. They know this is their everyday city, but they didn't think about what might lie beneath. So when you suggest to them that there could be, you know, hallowed ground on the one hand, but also haunted ground, I think, you know, that piques their interest. And so the reception to Ship of Souls has been absolutely amazing, beyond what I had hoped for. And to see kids excited about a book and come running up to you, boys especially, saying, I have to get this book, I have to get this book. And to have librarians email me and say, I've had kids coming in all day asking for your book. So that's really gratifying, because that was
that's
the whole
great.
Point. I know a couple of the reviewers have said, oh, it's too short, but you know, I know my community, for the community that I work with here in New York City, and I know that reluctant readers are intimidated by big books. It would be really difficult to hand a 300-page book to a child who is reluctant to read. But if you can hook them and then give them a book that they feel confident about finishing, and then you get them, can give them a little taste of it, and they're really excited. I dedicated the book to my young cousin, Cody, who's 11 years old, and you know, he was like, this is the best book I've ever read. And I wanted to say, how many books have you read? Because it is a compliment, but it's also relative to, you know, how much he's reading. And he, is growing up in a majority white community outside of Toronto, and he does not have books that feature black kids. He has nothing. The Canadian publishing industry is producing nothing for him. So it's important to me that I can give kids books where they can, you know, see themselves reflected, but also see beyond what they think they know into also what's possible and what has been here in the city.
That's great. I think that's great. And I think you hit a great point as far as presenting them with books that they're excited about finishing and books that they're confident that they could, you know, reach or confident that they can finish, and just being excited about it. I think that, you know, so oftentimes, you know, these big books or books in general just might seem intimidating to a lot of our young students. So,
our kids are growing up in the digital age. That's a challenge
that
for me as a college professor. I teach a literature class, and, you know, you'd be amazed at the number of students that come in and say, we have to read 8 books?
Right.
It's a 16-week semester. Of course you have to read 8 books. This is a 300-level literature class.
But if you don't read
recreationally, if you don't have a habit of picking up a book every day and reading while you're on the train, you know, they're texting, they're listening to their iPods, they're, you know, they're online, they're doing 10 different things at once. So having to put all of that down and just focus on, you know, turning the page. And I love it. If they have an e-reader, bring your e-reader to class. If you're reading on your phone, that's great. Bring it, you know, bring your phone. But it can be challenging because they have a lot of other things they could be spending their time and attention on.
Right.
Teaching kids to invest in sitting quietly for an hour and reading, that's challenging.
Excellent point. Excellent point. So out of your books, and I understand that you in reading your bio, you have several poems that are also published. And if I could just ask you, what got you into poetry?
Wow. Well, I used to tell people that I only wrote a poem when I was really angry. Generally only wrote one or two poems a year. But poetry at the time was easier to get published than a novel. So I think the first thing I finished was a novel, and I couldn't get it published. And so I started sending out poems and managed to get, you know, three or four or five of those published. I do write haiku kind of compulsively. I go through phases. And writing poetry, it helps you to kind of encapsulate things. You know, sometimes you have an experience and you could just write reams and reams of paper talking about how you feel. But when you're writing a poem, you have to be concise and you have to kind of distill the essence of that experience and say, this is what it reduces to. This is it. So I tended to write poems after I had an unfortunate romantic situation or I remember I was in, you know, Louisiana after Katrina, and all I could write was a poem. There was no way I could have written much more than that because of the emotional impact of that situation. So I would say I haven't written poems in quite a while because I've been writing novels and novellas, and I wrote plays for a couple of years, and then I just converted one of my plays into a short story, and that's going to be in an anthology about bullying that comes out in June.
Oh, wow.
Cornered. Yeah, so I have a lot of material, but the first thing that I managed to get published were my poems.
Great, that's great. And I know I just want to tell the audience that we didn't mention this to you before, but I'm wondering, would it be possible for you to possibly either recite a poem or read a portion of a book? And maybe if not right now, before we get off the air, if that's possible. I just wanted to put that in the atmosphere, if that is possible. And I did want to let the audience know that this is something we didn't ask you before. So if you're unable to do it, we do understand. I just wanted to put that in the atmosphere before I get to this next question.
Okay.
This next question is, which out of your books, which seems to be the most popular character as far as the feedback you've received? Which character has been the most popular?
Well, Ship of Souls isn't out yet, so I think it would be hard to say which one of those. And from A Wish After Midnight, it's definitely Jenna. She's the protagonist, and she's a 15-year-old girl. Her father's from Panamania, and her mother's African-American, and she has really big dreams for herself, and she wants to kind of move out of her neighborhood, which has got some not the great things going on, and she wants to go to an Ivy League school and become a psychiatrist. But when she gets sent back in time, you know, she realizes that even though she used to worry about being ghetto, quote-unquote, that when she's sent back to 1863, you know, having street smarts actually helps her. So there are moments where I think that's the trick for readers, and actually I teach the book in my college class, so it's not only a book for young readers but also for adults, and people relate to her because, you know, all of us think, well, if I was living back then, I wouldn't let nobody touch me, and blah, blah. You know, we all think that we would be so strong and nobody would be able to hold us back, and the truth is it was so complicated, and there was, you know, so many different forms of domination that, you know, getting over the psychological chains was almost harder than, you know, removing the shackles themselves. So I think when people see Jenna with her 21st century attitude trying to deal with some racist white people in 1863, they really cheer for her because they just feel like that's what they would want to say to someone who was, you know, being disrespectful, and whether or not that was actually possible for young black women in 1863.
Right. And is there an unpopular character or anything you've come across that maybe perhaps is one of the more unpopular characters?
Yeah, I would say Judah is sometimes unpopular, and he is Jenna's boyfriend, and he's Rastafarian.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was never that invested in staying in the United States. In the 21st century, Jenna's like, let's apply to the same college, let's go to college together. And he's like, you know, later for college. You know, the destiny of black people is to return to Africa, as per Marcus Garvey. And so, you know, he was looking for a way to get to Ethiopia. And then they both get sent back in time, and he's like, you know, this is insane. Jenna's like, we're going to find a way back to 2001. And he's like, no, you know, we have a chance to go to Liberia. We can go to this brand new country. You know, it's being run by black people. You know, that the African Civilization Society will send us back to Africa. You know, Jenna, that's where our future lies. So in one way, he's, you know, he's a black nationalist, and he teaches her to be proud of who she is, and he helps her to lock her hair, and he tells her she's beautiful. So people like that side of him, but the other side of him is he tends to think of her as a sellout. And so when she has another love interest come on the scene, they tend to vote for Team Paul as opposed to Team Judah. Some detractors, but
I think that's very interesting, because even in that story, for instance, the concept of black nationalism, what it might look like in the 21st century versus what it looked like in 1865, I think that's an interesting way to, you know, kind of show the evolution of this concept, if you want to call it evolution, or the varying degrees of the concept of black nationalism. I think that's a very interesting and creative way in how you brought that in your story. And you mentioned Marcus.
Go ahead. I was going to say, the course that I teach, one of the courses I teach is on neo-slave narratives, and that's precisely the purpose of looking at a contemporary representation of slavery, is that you can gauge progress. So here's what people were saying in 1863, and here's what we're saying in 2001. How much has actually changed? And that's Judah's argument, right? Jenna's like, but things are going to get better. The war is going to end. The Union's going to win. And he's like, and then there will be Jim Crow. And then we will have to fight again for civil rights. And then we're going to have to keep fighting it. He's like, you know, it doesn't really get better. So his argument is that if you have that long view of history, you can get, you should get out while you can. And Jenna's more of an optimist, I guess, and she's still believes that, you know, the American dream could be possible for someone like her.
That's great. And I'm not sure if you know, but I teach at Cheney University, which is an HBCU right outside of Philadelphia.
I
think that it would be great. I would like to stay in contact with you. I think it would be great if you could come to Cheney and just talk to our students about some of the things we're talking about, reading, and even the creativity in which you present your stories and your novels. I think that that's fascinating. I'm even interested. I mean, I know it's geared towards young readers, but I am looking forward to Ships of Souls coming out so I can. And, you know, I have a young daughter as well. Just to be able to present this to another generation of readers, I think that's very great.
Yeah. Well, I never had a chance to meet black writers. You know, I didn't meet a black writer until I came and lived here in the United States. And then I saw Maya Angelou. So she was the first for me. But when I go into those schools, I mean, Paquita Campoverde, who arranges the school visits for the Brooklyn Public Library, she always says to me, you know, these kids need to see you. Because I can't imagine what it would have meant if I had been 10 or 11 years old and a black woman author came to my school and talked about what it means to be a writer and how she fell in love with books and started writing stories. I mean, that can be really transformative for young people, because it's like, you know, President Obama. You never thought you could be president until you saw a black president. So I think being a role model in terms of an author and a scholar and an academic, as you are too, that's really important.
Great, good point. Now, and you mentioned in telling us the story I think it was Judah was his name, the Rastafarian. Yes, and you mentioned and you dropped the name of Marcus Garvey, and I was just thinking, have you dropped names of other African American icons in your readings? Because that's also a clever way to get the reader, familiar with these leaders.
Absolutely. Well, I'm working on the sequel to A Wish After Midnight, and Henry Highland Garnett, prominent abolitionist and activist in the black community and founder of the African Civilization Society, which was based in Weeksville, he becomes a mentor for Judah. And they have a few debates over whether or not blacks should be fighting in the Civil War. for the Union Army or whether they should be doing something else. So, yeah, I definitely try to weave in historical figures. There's another woman, I haven't exactly pinned down her identity, but it seems as though she visited Brooklyn after the war was over, and she was very, very fair-skinned and was able to pass for white and serve as a spy in the South during the Civil War. And I just thought, oh, imagine if she ran into Jenna or some of these other young women in the book, you know, what advice would she give them? So I definitely do try to weave in historical figures and, you know, not to preach to kids, but just to make them curious so that they can then go and Google that person and find out more about them. Yeah, point them in the right direction.
Good, good. And I heard that you mentioned 9/11, the mm-hmm. attacks of 9/11 and Ship of Souls. If you could just give us a synopsis, how did that intertwine?
It's a very brief mention, but because we're underground and because of the ship that was found at Ground Zero, mm-hmm. I didn't feel that I could have my three kids underground in Lower Manhattan without referencing 9/11. So there's a moment where they're underground and they're searching for the ship, and suddenly they feel as though they're sinking in a wave of sadness. And prior to that, they had been kind of bickering and arguing with each other and figuring out who was in the lead and who was in control. And as soon as that wave of sadness washes over them, they kind of reach out and try to comfort each other. And the Muslim character, Hakim, says, you know, I think we're passing Ground Zero right now. And that kind of quashes the disputes that they were having. And they remember that, you know, they have a lot to be thankful for and that there were lots of souls, not only the souls of enslaved Africans, but there are lots of souls who, you know, might still be seeking peace. So.
Good. And your other works or in the upcoming works, do you mention any other current events? Or is that something that you do throughout even this book, the mention of current events?
I mean, what's unfortunate is that whenever I think most writers, a lot of writers, if you're writing realistic fiction, you're writing about your contemporary reality. But publishing mm-hmm. takes so long that by the time your book gets in print, it's now historical fiction because so many years have passed. So, you know, I finished A Wish After Midnight in 2003. And it ends with 9/11, but, you know, that book didn't come out until I self-published it in 2008, and then it was acquired by Amazon and re-released in 2010. So Ship of Souls I wrote during the blizzard of 2010 here in New York City. And, of course, I had to write about the fact that there was a blizzard in the city, and I did incorporate one of the very sad stories, which was that a pregnant woman here in Brooklyn couldn't get down her block to get to an ambulance, and the ambulance couldn't get to her, and she went into labor in the lobby of an apartment building, and her baby died.
Wow.
Something that horrible, that's in the book. And the sequel, The Ship of Souls, addresses the Japanese earthquake and tsunami, and hopefully that will come out next year, so it won't be too far removed, and it'll still be in people's memories, but that is the challenge with publishing, is that you can write about something that's happening to you now, but if the book takes 3, 4, 5, 10 years to come out, then it's no longer as current.
Good point. Now, are there any dreams of perhaps adapting your writings to, you know, maybe television, cartoons, things of that sort?
Mm-hmm. Well, my collaborator, the artist that illustrated my picture book, Bird, she was very interested in having the picture book made into a play, and there have been a couple of other young adult authors, Christopher Myers and Jacqueline Woodson, who have recently had their books adapted into plays, so that's one possibility. Everyone who reads my novels, A Wish After Midnight, and especially Ship of Souls, says, oh my goodness, this has to be a movie, and I do think I write with a kind of cinematic style, but you know, it takes money to have something made into a film. And so you have to have a producer who has enough money to buy the option, and then, you know, even more money to try to find a studio. And with everything we've just heard about George Lucas and him trying to get Red Tails made, we know that it's hard out there for black filmmakers. So unless the Disney Corporation comes knocking, it's hard to imagine how that could happen, but you know, we have people out there who are willing to to fund projects and to start their own production companies, and indie filmmakers, you know, like Dee Reese, they're making it happen every day. So I keep mm-hmm. that open. It's definitely a dream. I would love to see it, and I think our kids deserve to see, you know, an exciting adventure film starring someone who looks like them. We have a lot of young adult novels like the Harry Potter series and now the Hunger Games that are being turned into films, but, you know, they don't star children of color.
Right. And not too long ago, the Gist of Freedom interviewed a brother. His name was Dawood, and he publishes black action figure comic books. And he's kind of big in the industry, so in an effort to help you out or maybe help him out, I think I would pass your name on to him. I think that might be something. Because just learning about your book, I'm picturing like a movie or a cartoon or a show in my mind as you tell me what the book is about, which I know this is what books are supposed to do, but I can see, like you said, you write with a cinematic style. I could see it as a movie or a cartoon or a series or something of that sort. You know, I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would be great.
No,
I watch.
Right.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I know that I just wanted to talk a couple minutes about your work in the education arena. In reading your bio, it says you've taught black feminist cultural criticism at mm-hmm. different colleges. And if you could just explain to our listeners, what is that specifically? You know, black feminist cultural criticism. What is it that they're trying to, what's the point that they're trying to get across or trying to make?
Sure. Well, black feminists have a particular lens through which they view the world, and so I'm specifically looking at culture. I was mostly focusing on literature in graduate school, but I also looked at music and film and theater. And so a black feminist cultural criticism takes into account a black feminist viewpoint that is interested in equity. So mm-hmm. I know a lot of people think that feminism is about man bashing, but that is not true. There are actually feminisms. And so for me, black feminism takes into account intersectionality. So I don't only look at race and I don't only look at gender. You look at race and gender and sexuality and class and age and region. You look at mm-hmm. a number of different things all at once. And you look for distinctions. So things that are like a black feminist response to things that happen within the world of hip-hop would focus mm-hmm. on whether black women and girls are being treated fairly, but it would also look at the construction of black masculinity and how that is impacting men, because next semester I'll actually be teaching, right now I teach black women in the Americas, and next semester I'll also be teaching the black male. And so that'll be an opportunity to help my students think about black masculinities and the expectations that are put on black men, and the ways in which their individual identities often run up against these expectations and stereotypes and dominant images, some of which we create, but most of which we don't. And so a situation like Too Short, I don't know if you heard about that, the rapper.
Yes,
who,
indeed. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Put out a video that was extremely problematic and telling young
right.
boys how to assault young women.
Right.
And you know, that took a group of black feminists who love hip hop to say, "Brother, we love you, but that was messed up and here's what you can do about it." And they sat down and schooled him, and he listened and then had a response.
Right.
I think it was Dream Hampton he did an interview with.
Right.
So I'm not that into hip-hop, but I do cover hip-hop in my classes, and it's important to help students realize that you can consume something and not realize that it's harmful for you, or not realize right. just how complicated it is. And sometimes when you do sit down and look at it, as I say to my students, you know, I can ruin your favorite love song in about 5 minutes, but it changes the way you look at things, and you realize that, you know, race is constructed and gender is constructed. And if you really just want to be who you are, then you might have to fight for that identity. And sometimes, you know, being part of a group like the black community, you're expected to put your needs as a woman second to the needs of the race, but, you know, Black feminists have taught us that it's very important to speak up and say, you know, all of us have to advance together as one. We can't leave certain members behind and say, we'll get to you later. So Black feminism for me is about equity. So it's looking for examples of inequity, but also examples of people who get it right, because there are a lot of people, even in hip-hop, who get it right, and they should be applauded, right. And we should look to them as an example of how things can be.
Thank you for that. We thank you. Now, earlier I asked if you had an opportunity, if you would like to read or recite any of your poetry. So if you would like that opportunity, I wanted to extend that to you now. And I know we didn't ask you this before, but if you wanted that opportunity, you're more than welcome to have a few minutes to do that now. Is that something you're comfortable doing or prepared to do at this point?
You know, I don't have poems committed to memory. I can read a little bit of A Wish After Midnight since I have it here in front of me.
Sure.
I can do that. How much time do I have?
Sure, you have about 30 seconds to a minute.
30 seconds to a minute. Okay. All right, I'll give this a try. There's a. I'm just going to change some of the language in this.
You know what? You have up to 5 minutes, so we have 5 minutes,
Okay.
Yes.
So this is a scene where Jenna, who has been sent back in time, and she's working for a rich white family. They're abolitionists, and they are not exactly friendly towards Black people. So she interrupts a scene where her boss, Mrs. Brandt, white woman, is having a problem with the housekeeper whose name is Nanny.
Mm.
So Jenna says, even though I'm living in a whole other century, whenever I'm around Mrs. Brandt, all my ghetto comes out. In my mind, I don't even call her Mrs. Brandt. I call her witch, or the witch, or that witch. My mouth says, yes, Mrs. Brandt, right away, Mrs. Brandt. But in my mind, I'm thinking, do it yourself, witch. But I can't say those things to Mrs. Brandt, because Mrs. Brandt's a white lady, she's rich, and she's married to a hotshot doctor. I'm Black, I'm poor, and in this world, nobody's got my back. Mrs. Brandt's got everybody fooled, everybody except Nanny and me. I know what she's really like, because I see how she lives. I see how she treats Nanny, and I see how she won't give none to Dr. Brandt, and I see how she smiles at all those abolition ladies, but then screams at Nanny when the bread's a little bit burnt or the sheets aren't folded just so. I see how even her own son can't stand her. She comes near Henry, and he starts to wail and fuss, and his little face gets all red. She's like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. She's a fake. And one of these days, if I get the chance, I'm going to blow up her spot in front of everybody so they can see just what kind of person she really is. One day I'm bringing Henry down from his nap, and I hear Mrs. Brandt hollering at Nanny in the kitchen. I know there must be trouble, because Mrs. Brandt almost never goes back there. What for? She's got Nanny doing all the cooking and baking and ironing and washing. That woman doesn't lift a finger all day, but right now she's pitching a fit. Soon as I get closer to the door, I can hear part of what she's saying. It's something about the cakes for her afternoon tea party. I stand there behind the closed door wondering whether or not to go in. I know Nanny doesn't like it when I interfere, and no one likes to get chewed out in front of someone else. I decide to take Henry back upstairs to the nursery when all of a sudden I hear a sound that makes my back itch. Swap, and then again, swap. Then the blows start coming too fast for me to count, and before I know what I am doing, I am kicking that door so hard it slams against the wall, and I am setting Henry down too hard on the kitchen floor so that he topples over and starts to cry. And even with her own child crying and me coming around that table, Mrs. Brandt doesn't let up. That hard, flat wooden spoon in her hand keeps going up and coming down, and Nanny, she's taking the blows like someone who already knows what hurt's about. But Mrs. Brandt, she's trying to teach Nanny something new. And then I get around the table, and I grab the spoon from out her hand, except the witch won't let go. And when I grab it, she holds on tight and spins around like she's going to hit me next, except I don't play that. And before Nanny can blurt out, no, I slap that witch right across the face. That surprises her so bad, she lets go of the spoon, and I'm about to go upside her head with it when Dr. Brandt bursts into the kitchen with a real loud, "What the devil's going on in here?" Little Henry screaming and dragging himself across the floor so he can latch onto my leg. Henry's crying, but Nanny's eyes are dry, and Mrs. Brandt's face is turning purple. She's so mad, she's about to blow up, and if Dr. Brandt hadn't grabbed her arm, she'd have tried to crack that iron poker right over my head. She tried to kill me, that witch, and it's a good thing Dr. Brandt got between us, because if that woman ever took a swing at me, it'd be over. Here she is, half my height, half my weight, her ugly face looking worse than ever, because it's turning all different shades of red, and she wants to fight me. Dr. Brandt finally pries the poker out of her hand and shakes her, saying, Amelia, Amelia, get a hold of yourself. He's saying it over and over like she don't know who she is, like she's somebody else right now, and he can call her back just by saying her name. Dr. Brandt keeps on shaking his stupid, ugly, evil wife, and after a while her face turns white and her body goes limp, and Dr. Brandt lays her out on the floor and tells Nanny to go get the smelling salts. I only need one glance from Nanny to know she won't ever thank me for this. I drop the spoon on the table, scoop Henry up in my arms, and walk on out the kitchen. Should I stop there?
Oh, that's great. I was into it. Great. Thank you for that. And before we sign off, if you can, again, just repeat the title of your upcoming book and tell us again about the party opening.
Sure. The upcoming book is called Ship of Souls. It's suitable for kids age 11 and up, and it is released on February 28th, which is Tuesday. You can pre-order it now on Amazon, or it will be available on Amazon. You can try getting it from your indie bookstore, but Barnes & Noble is refusing to carry Amazon books, so you probably won't find it at Barnes & Noble. You will find it at the gift shop of the African Burial Ground National Monument, and that's where we will be on Saturday between 1 and 3. Everyone is welcome. It's free. We're going to have cake and refreshments. I'm giving a little PowerPoint presentation. It's a great opportunity to learn more about the history of enslaved Africans and the contributions they made to the founding of New York City.
And that is Saturday, March 3rd, correct?
Saturday, March 3rd, this coming Saturday.
Great. Again, we thank you, Dr. Elliott, for taking time out to talk to us about several things, your upcoming books, your experience in Canada, and just the lens out of which you work out of. We appreciate you for your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to share my work with your listeners. Have a good evening.
You too. And for all those listeners, we thank you for listening this week. Until next time, God bless.